This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. On the line with us is Robert Wright. He is the professor, visiting professor of science and religion at Union Theological Seminary in New York, the author of numerous books, including his most recent, Why Buddhism is True, his website, Robert Wright, WRIGHT.com, and mindfulresistance.net. You can tweet him at Robert Wright-er. Do I have that right, Robert?
That's all right so far, yeah.
Okay, great. And at Union Seminary. Robert, brilliant new book, Why Buddhism is True. I read part of it as one of our book reports here for our program. Yeah. I love this book.
Thank you.
To start at the beginning, to explain Buddhism to people who have no experience with or of it, what do you say?
Well, first, I'm focusing on what you could call the naturalistic part. In other words, not things like rebirth, the kind of supernatural aspects of Buddhism. But, you know, I think at the center of Buddhism is a kind of amazing claim, which is that the reason we suffer and the reason we make other people suffer, in other words, the reason we're mean to people, is because we don't see the world clearly. And so by clarifying our vision, in a sense, by clarifying our perception of ourselves, our perception of others, we'll become happier people and better people. And that's the claim that I defend in the book, and I argue that it actually makes a lot of sense from the standpoint of modern psychology and modern philosophy.
My recollection, it's been 40 years, but my recollection of the Buddha's Four Noble Truths were that number one, all life is suffering. Number two, all suffering is caused by attachment. Number three, eliminate the attachment, you eliminate the suffering. And then number four was the Eightfold Path to achieve that separation from attachment. Do I have that right? Is my memory still functioning?
It's close enough for our purposes.
Okay.
I mean, I can put some footnotes in there that some of which are interesting, actually. I mean, for example, the did say that life is full of something that's commonly translated as suffering. The word that's translated as suffering could also be translated, some people would say, as kind of unsatisfactoriness. So a big part of suffering as Buddhism sees it is the fact that we're just never, you know, we're just kind of chronically not entirely happy with our situation. We always want things to be a little better. Mm-hmm. And when we get a thrill, it fades quickly. You know, you buy that latest thing that's going to make you happy, the coolest smartphone, you get the promotion, whatever it is that's going to make you happy, the thrill fades, and then you want a little more. So I would just say that's a big part of the suffering. It's not the only part, but it's a big part of the suffering.
Sure.
The Buddhism sets out
this dissatisfaction. Yeah. So the subtitle of your book is The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. For somebody who doesn't want to sit and meditate for 15 or 30 minutes a day or whatever, how do you apply the tenets, the principles of Buddhism to our modern political dialectic?
Well, I do think, I mean, I agree with the many people who have said that we have a problem in the country with political polarization, or you could call it tribalism. And I think that's tribalism's a problem around the world, whether it's sectarian conflict or conflict between nations, or in our case, conflict within a nation. And I think, you know, it is driven in all these cases by something you could call the psychology of tribalism. And, you know, in keeping with Buddhist teaching, I think that does consist of distortions of perception and cognition. Again, Buddhism says we tend, you know, kind of naturally not to see the world clearly. I think we do suffer from a lot of what are now called cognitive biases, and they do drive this political polarization. A famous one now is confirmation bias. That's gotten a certain amount of attention. That's just a tendency to notice and embrace evidence that supports your pre-existing views, and to not notice or even reject, if you do notice it, evidence that seems at odds with your views. And it's interesting that you should ask, like, well, suppose you don't meditate. I think even if you don't meditate, I mean, I think you may be able to address this problem better if you do mindfulness meditation, but even if you don't meditate, here's what I'd recommend you try, is if you're on Twitter or Facebook or something, and you see some politically relevant information, You know, if you're anti-Trump, it's information that isn't good for Trump. If you're pro-Trump, it's maybe information that supports him. But you start to retweet it or to share it on Facebook. I would say pay very close attention to your feelings as you do that. Ask yourself, what exactly is driving the retweeting or the sharing on Facebook? And I think if you pay enough attention, you'll notice that it's a feeling. I mean, you have like an affection for that information. You know, you like the, and you want to like the information that supports your side of the argument. And so really it's a feeling more than a thought, more than deliberation, that's driving you to share the information. And sometimes we do so uncritically without examining it. We don't really want to examine it. We hope that, we won't find anything wrong with it because it supports our views. So you may notice that it's a feeling that is behind this thing we call confirmation bias, which leads us to embrace this evidence consistent with our views. Now, I would say if you do mindfulness meditation every morning, you'll probably find it a little easier to notice the feelings and to stop yourself from uncritically following their promptings. In other words, finding some space for actual rational reflection before you act. Because mindfulness meditation, one of the main things it does is make you more aware of various aspects of the way your mind works, certainly including your feelings, and gives you the ability to get, in a certain sense, a kind of a critical distance from them. So there's one problem that I think we do see in play in modern politics that you can address with or without meditating. I recommend meditation. I'm an advocate, but it's not absolutely necessary.
There's one of the I think pervasive myths about Buddhist meditation and sitting in particular is that it is somehow passive, that it's weak, that it's kind of giving up, it's surrendering. Louise and I have practiced Soto Zen for decades. We started with the Atlanta Soto Zen Center years ago. I spent a week in Dharamsala in McLeod Ganj. In fact, it was made into a movie narrated by Harrison Ford, Dalai Lama Renaissance. We spent a week with the Dalai Lama 4 hours a day ultimately took refuge from him.
I should be interviewing you about Buddhism.
Yeah.
You should be interviewing me.
Well, it was fascinating because one of the things that he organized for us was these young monks, these teenage monks, doing their Tibetan Buddhist dialectic, their debate, essentially. And the debate was, what is the nature of a pot, right? And these guys would come forward and they would just, with great emphasis and shouting and waving their hands and jumping up and down. And the idea that meditation is easy and that it's not struggle, and the idea that Buddhist thought is passive is about as far from my experience as you can get. Your reaction to that and how this can meaningfully become part of our lives in a way that doesn't just put its hooks into us and drag us off like you were talking about earlier with the distraction and seduction of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say first of all, if you think it's easy or all fun and games, go to a serious 1 week silent meditation retreat, which is what got me first got me kind of hooked on meditation. But it's very hard. I mean, you're meditating intensively all day, but first of all, you realize how hard it is to focus on your breath, which is the way you start a lot of kinds of meditation. Very hard to do, and then as the week wears on, you find yourself actually dealing with a lot of feelings you're in the habit of running away from. Or dealing with by like eating junk food or changing the subject or something, and that can be very taxing and challenging. I mean, I sometimes say like going on a meditation retreat is like extreme sports for the mind, and it has its dangers. It can be hard. It has its ups and downs. It has its wonderful moments, and that's why I keep coming back. But it's challenging, and more fundamentally, I'd say you have to recognize like what is at the core of Buddhist philosophy. Is the idea that you should be able to withstand any situation whatsoever without running away from it, right? I mean, it's very stoic.
Including death.
Has a lot. Go ahead, yeah.
Including death.
Including death, yeah. I mean, now, of course, what you might call religious Buddhists in Asia do have the consolation of rebirth, somewhat as Christians have the consolation of heaven or the prospect of heaven. And the idea is, in that context, that if you live a good ethical life, you have a better chance at a favorable rebirth. But for the many people who are what you could call secular Buddhists or naturalistic Buddhists, and that includes a lot of the Buddhists in the West, including me, you know, there is death is one of the many things you are trying to learn how to handle stoically. And I know people who have gone further down the meditation path than I am. I mean, I'm still a novice relative to them, but in talking to them, I think they really have made their peace with it to an extent that the rest of us find very challenging. But yeah, death, pain, I mean, you know, people, serious meditation can help you cope with serious pain, back pain or whatever. Anxiety is,
it can help you, it can help you cope with Trump.
Well, yeah, that's the biggest challenge of them all if you're of my political persuasion.
Yeah. There you go. Same here. I bring my meditation practice into my debates on a daily basis. Robert Wright, Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. Robert, thank you for dropping by.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
And for writing a brilliant book.
Thanks.
Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
RobertWright.com is his website, mindfulresistance.net. You can tweet him at Robert Writer, WRIGHTER. We'll be right back.